Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network, and we're doing all things political just a little bit late because yesterday was Memorial Day, and there's a lot to talk about today. It's the kind of news cycle where there's something new to talk about every single day. We have a lot to talk about with Jonathan Allen this hour of the program, and Jonathan has written a recent book on Hillary Clinton, Shattered Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign. He's a contributor at Roll Call and head of community and content at TKTK Sidewear. In the past, he was a reporter at Politico. We have, there's so much on the table today. There's a story from CNN that Russian government officials discussed having potentially derogatory information about then-presidential candidate Donald Trump and some of his top aides in conversations that were intercepted by U.S. intelligence during the election. We'll be looking at Jared Kushner's back-channel move. Was this acceptable in building dialogue with a foreign government? Adam Schiff, the top-ranking Democrat on the House committee who is investigating potential collusion, called for a review of Jared Kushner's security clearance. Donald Trump's personal attorney is now included in the Russia investigation. The director of communications resigned today. The president is saying, it's my opinion that many of the leaks coming out of the White House are fabricated lies made up by false news media. The president concluded his foreign visits to a number of countries. Many are saying it was quite successful. But Angela Merkel has said that the U.S. president's actions have weakened the West and has accused the U.S. government of standing against the interests of the European Union. So there's a lot going on. And that's just a few of the items that we'll be discussing this hour and welcoming your phone calls for Jonathan. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter as well at K Dunn Show. And we'll be very happy to take your calls as we carry along here. Jonathan, thank you very much for being with us. Hi.
My pleasure to be back with you.
Yeah, it's been a while. Thank you so much. Well, this Russia investigation is really heating up at a pretty rapid fire pace, as you well know. The big news is still Jared Kushner's back channel move. Some are saying it was acceptable in building dialogue. But, you know, he has this strange meeting with the Russian ambassador, and then he has this meeting with this high-level banking guy who has deep ties to Vladimir Putin. What do you think that meeting was all about? Why would Kushner meet with a Russian banker? What for?
Well, I can't speak to it in terms of knowing what was said, but, you know, you start to build this sort of circumstances here, and I think it's important to remember that at the time, this particular bank was under U.S. sanctions, essentially because of its proximity to Putin and as retaliation from the United States against Putin's aggression in Ukraine. And so I think what you had was an administration that was coming in that was looking at possibly repealing some of those sanctions. We still don't know exactly what the Russian investment is in Jared Kushner's businesses or in Donald Trump's businesses. And so I think there are a lot of questions to be answered, and probably Jared Kushner is the only person who can answer this question.
And he said he will testify. Do you know when he might testify and if he will testify before the House Intelligence Committee?
I think it's not clear right now who would get first crack at him. Presumably the special counsel has first crack at whoever he wants first crack at, and there's obviously some overlap between the House and Senate investigations and that special counsel investigation. You know, it makes sense for him to say that he's going to come and talk. There's no reason for him to, you know, to be difficult about it. And I mean, I think the question is, what will he talk about? What will they ask him? And will any of us ever get any real insight into that in terms of the public?
Mm-hmm. The president just seems to answer all of this with tweets about the fake news media. He yesterday tweeted unfair media coverage. He keeps on that same theme. Is there some reason, and would you advise, if you were one of his advisors, to sort of have a big press conference or an address to the nation and talk about what in the world is going on?
I think that unless he's willing to make clear what his financial situation is and the extent to which he's invested in Russia, or more importantly, Russians are invested in him. You know, whatever he would say at a press conference would seem to be evasive. I mean, this is the big question: is Donald Trump, is the president of the United States, beholden to Russian interests? And if the answer is no, and you know, I mean, he has said that that's not the case, but unless he can sort of you know, make that evidence available, you know, I think it's going to be hard for him to stop the stories, because there's a lot of intrigue around it.
And Jonathan, will the special counsel Mueller be able to subpoena those tax records?
That's a good question. I think the answer to that is yes, but presumably Donald Trump's lawyers will fight that, and so who knows how long that might take to do. But I think, generally speaking, the ability of the special counsel to get private investment records is probably pretty strong.
Mm-hmm. We have this report today from CNN. I'd like for you to respond to it. Russian government officials discussed having potentially derogatory information about then-presidential candidate Donald Trump and some of his top aides in conversations that were intercepted by U.S. intelligence during the election. One source described the information as financial in nature and said the discussion centered on whether the Russians had leverage over Trump's inner circle.
And I think that's the $64,000 question. Now, some have suggested, and I'm sure that this is true, that Russians who are speaking on lines that they know or in places that they know are monitored by the U.S. may sometimes put out disinformation. So it's obviously a possibility. But again, this gets to that question of, you know, exactly what Donald Trump owes to which Russians, if anything.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, is he in debt to them? Do they have investments in his properties? And those kinds of questions. And so we're still building the picture here. And it may turn out that the picture shows nothing more nefarious than Donald Trump believing that the United States should have a different foreign policy that is more agreeable to Russia and less agreeable to some of the United States' long-term European allies. He certainly campaigned that way.
Right. Do you think that's the case?
You know, there's a lot of smoke right now. I would hesitate to make a... make a blanket assessment that this is only because of what Donald Trump owes, only because of Donald Trump's policy leanings, wholly uninfluenced by business practices. But again, we don't know what Donald Trump owes.
Mm-hmm. I believe it was David Brooks who wrote today that Jared Kushner's role in the White House may now be in peril. Do you think it is, Jonathan?
Yes and no. I mean, the one thing that could create some sort of divide between the president and his son-in-law is the son-in-law having some sort of legal problem that's hard for the president to deal with. But I think we know of this president that blood is thicker than water, and even though Jared Kushner isn't his blood, he's pretty close to it. I think it's interesting that Kushner comes back to all of these, and Trump comes back from overseas to all these stories about Kushner at a time when Steve Bannon, the White House chief strategist, and Reince Priebus, the White House chief of staff, had peeled off of that trip early. So they were back in Washington planning for a week, and then all of a sudden there are all these stories about Kushner. I'm not saying they're the sources of those, but it is interesting timing.
Where are
they? They've obviously been competing with Kushner for power.
Right. And there have been so many of these stories sources have told so many different news outlets. Do you have any idea where they're all coming from? Are they disgruntled intelligence people because they have a bad relationship with the administration, or because we're getting source after source after source?
I mean, it's hard to know. You know, whose sources are when they're on background, and I would hesitate to guess at as professional courtesy, wouldn't guess, you know, too deeply at the sources the specific sources of reporters reporting. But the breadth with which this has been reported, I mean, oftentimes these stories say 8 or 9 sources in the intelligence community.
Right.
Clearly, there are a lot of people talking, and I would be surprised if some of them are not internal.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about
meaning people who work for Donald Trump at a political level.
Really? And why would that be? Why would they want to say something about the boss that's not positive?
Well, maybe more that they're trying to say something about the boss's son-in-law that's not positive.
I see.
I mean, we saw you know, both sides of the Michael Flynn situation played, and then Flynn got dismissed. I mean, I think there's a I think that these guys understand that one of the ways to weaken somebody else is to do it through the press, because Trump pays so much attention to what the media is saying. Mm.
And we kept hearing that there, once he returned from his foreign trip, there would be a lot of staff shakeups. Communications director evidently resigned today. Do you anticipate there will be more? Do you hear anything about who those people might be?
So the thinking has been that the communications shop in general would see a big shakeup. Obviously, the resignation of the communications director, which was actually turned in on May 18th before the trip, is the first edge of that. Rather than seeing people dismissed, my guess is that you will see some people rise and some people fall in terms of their influence and their visibility. It looks like Sean Spicer is going to take on a reduced role. You know, it sounds like Corey Lewandowski, Trump's first campaign manager, and David Bossie, who's the deputy campaign manager at one point on the campaign, are likely to come into the White House to sort of run a kind of war room. I think Trump feels like the response from his White House has not been aggressive enough.
Mm-hmm.
My general take on blaming the communication staff is that poor communications are symptomatic of larger problems, not causal.
And why bring Lewandowski back? What's going to be his role?
Well, he's aggressively loyal to Trump, and I think that's part of it. And he likes combat. He relishes combat. The Axios, which is a Washington publication, reported this morning that Trump wants to bring in what he thinks of as the killers.
Oh.
And Lewandowski is in that mold. So, you know, I mean, it appears that the president's analysis of the situation is that his team is not effectively defending him and not effectively going after other people aggressively, going after his detractors.
Is Steve Bannon in that killer mode as well?
I think Bannon is looked at as a killer. You know, I don't think there's anybody that looks at Bannon as soft. Here's a guy who basically, you know, corralled the white nationalist movement in favor of Donald Trump and has strong alliances outside the White House. There were so many stories about how Steve Bannon was going to be gone, he was going to be gone, he was going to be gone, and yet he's still there. And I think part of that is because he's in touch with the president's base in a way that even the president may not always be.
Mm-hmm. The president just finished this foreign trip. On the whole, would you say it was successful or problematic?
Depends on who you are. I think
right.
I think it was successful for the president in terms of he went overseas without any major gaffes. You know, there was a little bit of chuckling over him shoving his way into the front past the prime minister of Montenegro at one point. And his wife slapping his hand away a couple of times.
Right.
But there were no major gaffes on this trip. But I think that I think he's really pushed the United States away from its traditional European allies. And I think there are a lot of people who find that troublesome.
Angela Merkel saying within the last 24 hours, the U.S. president's actions have weakened the West, accusing the U.S. government of standing against the interests of the European Union. Her words were pretty harsh.
No doubt. And what's really interesting about that is that it comes on the heels of a G7 meeting. And at the G7 meetings, you know, these leaders meet in private and they don't really, it's not that nobody takes notes, but there's no official record of what gets said. And, you know, from people I've talked to in the national security sphere, the takeaway from that is that whatever Trump said behind closed doors, whatever he said privately, was even more aggressive than what he said publicly.
Mm-hmm. He declined to endorse NATO's Article 5, refused to endorse, and evidently was the only one, the Paris Climate Accord. Could he change his mind on the Paris Climate Accord? And why would you not endorse NATO's Article 5?
I don't think he believes in the idea that the United States should be committed to mutual self-defense with all of these smaller nations. I mean, I think that's part and parcel of what he campaigned on. The idea that we weren't going to go out there and, you know, start wars all over the world to defend other people or to protect other people. This is a longstanding commitment to NATO. So obviously, you know, presidents, Republican and Democratic, have supported that. Interestingly, this happened at a a memorial, or, you know, when he spoke, it was at a, and didn't mention Article 5, it was at a, an event memorializing September 11th, which is the only time that Article 5 has ever been invoked, was in favor of the United States. You know, and I think there are a lot of internationalists and people who have been involved in diplomacy for a long time who think that this is really sort of a scary road to go down, because it is, they believe it is beneficial to the United States to have peace and to have basically agreements with all the non-aggression agreements in addition to mutual protection agreements with all these countries.
Mm-hmm. And the whole scene in Saudi Arabia was quite a sight, wasn't it? Why do we keep having, you know, it's not just this administration after administration having these huge weapons contracts with Saudi Arabia. Why do we do that?
Well, the money's good.
I guess it is. The money's really good, huh?
Right, $300 billion. Nothing to sneeze at, right? I think that, I think number one, that's it. They're a buyer for our weapons, and they, you know, I mean, there's an element to, like, keeping our defense industry alive without us spending that money. Also, I think, you know, there's a belief in this administration, I think in previous administrations, that the Saudi royal family can be an effective ally at times in trying to sustain peace in the Middle East, even though obviously historically Saudi Arabia has been a big funder of terrorism and obviously has supports a lot of people who are hostile to Israel and to other U.S. allies in the region. But this is an administration that is leaning away from Tehran and toward Riyadh, toward the Saudis and away from the Iranians.
Mm-hmm.
Iranians. I think you see that in this weapons deal. But that said, it wouldn't be shocking if Barack Obama had signed the same weapons deal or George W. Bush or Bill Clinton. We've seen this for years and years. You can go back actually and see in the early 1980s a young Joe Biden asking why it was in the interest of the United States to make a Saudi arms deal. It's a debate that's gone on for a long time, and those who are in favor of selling weapons to Saudi Arabia have won that debate consistently.
Mm-hmm. At least it got the headlines off what's going on with the Russia investigation. I'm just wondering, Jonathan, considering the relentless news on this, it's day after day after day after day, we're not hearing anything about tax reform or about what's going to happen with health care, what the president wants in his budget, what is really important to him. All of those issues are just off on the side. Is that the fault of the news media for not covering it, or is it just that everybody in Washington, his administration, is so consumed with all these investigations, they just can't move off it?
Well, I think the consumption of investigations is a big part of it, but also on the domestic front, I think President Trump would love to have some legislative victories to be able to point to and to talk about. But the problem is the Republican Party that leads in Washington is divided on what to do over health care. The House passed a bill that appears to be a non-starter in the Senate. So the Senate has to go through its legislative process to maybe try to do something or bring up the House bill and risk that it fails. Tax reform is probably even harder. We've seen several major health care laws passed over the course of the past 30 years. But tax reform, the last time there was a big tax reform bill was 1986. So that's even harder probably than health care. There's not an easy place for the president to go. And by the way, a lot of the plans that have been released from the White House and from Congress would take away benefits or hurt a lot of people who voted for President Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Just if you look at the distribution of economic benefits. I mean, you know, here's a good example just from Wisconsin. The House health care bill would take $834 billion out of Medicaid over the next 10 years. And in addition to that, the White House budget actually foresees more of that. And the budget director can't say, or the budget director and the Treasury Secretary between them cannot agree on exactly how much money they're taking from Medicaid, but two-thirds of all Wisconsin births are subsidized by Medicaid right now, according to the Kaiser Foundation. So there are a lot of people who benefit, from these programs that are looking at a big scalpel, and I think that's the biggest problem right now in terms of trying to get that legislative agenda through. It's hard to get away from the narrative that benefits are being cut in order to give tax cuts to the wealthy, and I think that's not what a lot of people who voted for President Trump were looking for.
And I guess we're beginning to see that reflected in the polls now. There was a poll out, I believe, today that shows that support among his core supporters was at, what, 30%, and now is at 20, or it was at 40 and is now at 30. He's losing people who really love him.
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing some slippage. And what's interesting about that is you never really saw that during the campaign or even for the first couple months of the administration. The one thing you could count on was going back to that base time and again and finding it solid. But I think it's starting to show some cracks. I mean, a lot of, you know, he ran against corruption in Washington, and right now there are multiple investigations into the ties of the Trump operation with the Russian government. And, you know, there is some suggestion that it basically comes down to him owing Russia money.
Mm-hmm. And how are Republicans responding to all of this? I mean, are you finding an increasing number of Republicans, Jonathan, who are worried about this presidency? Are you finding less and less support among Republicans in Congress or not?
I think what you're hearing is concern articulated as optimism for ways in which the president could change course and do things better. And I think that's, you know, as much as you're going to hear for a while from Republicans, mm-hmm. The midterm elections aren't until 2018. Right now, the president still enjoys the overwhelming support of Republicans across the country. And until it gets to, you know, until he's at the point where it's more costly to your average Republican lawmaker to be with him than to be against him, more costly to be against him than with him, then they will stay with him.
We're going to...
These guys are politicians. Now, I do think he has a lower reservoir of support among Republican elected officials than some of his predecessors in the presidency. That is to say, I think there were guys that would have, you know, walked the plank for George W. Bush, even if it meant losing their own elections. I think that most of the people in the Republican Party in Congress right now will not stay with him beyond the point at which it's harmful to them.
Mm. And I'm wondering, at what point does it become harmful? Those midterm elections are getting pretty darn close. Are Republicans worried about a certain number, and how many might that be of elections? Or are the Democrats so disorganized and not able to come up with really good candidates that the Republicans don't have to worry?
Yes. No, I think that... I think Republicans are worried. You're talking about the Senate is probably secure for Republicans because of the set of seats. The Senate, only one-third of the seats are up every 2 years, and the ones that are up this time largely benefit Republicans. I mean, that is to say, they have a lot of they have safe incumbents up, and there just isn't a lot of opportunity for Democrats. In the House, however, you're talking about a two-dozen seat flip to change control. We've seen several elections in the last, you know, 20 or 30 years in which a party has been able to convert that kind of a number. So it's certainly possible that Democrats could take control. And you know, unlike a presidential election, I think in a congressional election, you're much more likely to be able to win without offering some unified national, you know, idea for what your party's going to do. I think sometimes you can win on just the idea of sending a message to the president.
Mm. What message did Montana send last week? This is quite a story. This guy who beats up the reporter from The Guardian, and then he gets elected. I don't know if it would have changed if early voting had not been so many early votes. But this guy's going to Congress, and then he has to go back for a hearing on assault.
Yeah, it's
whoa.
Interesting. Usually you're in Congress before you commit felonies or misdemeanors. And,
right.
This guy's just a congressman-elect. I think that, you know, as you pointed out, most of the voting was done in early voting. This is still a situation, and by the way, he did worse on the day of voting than he had done in the early voting. Mm. But still, you're talking about a state that is, you know, pretty solidly Republican. You know, I think Trump won by 20 points or 22 points or something in Montana, so... a congressional candidate on the Republican side winning by 5 or 6 points is, you know, not an indication of incredible strength. Also, the Democratic candidate there was not particularly strong. You know, I'm not sure how much he can take from that one election. I think there have been a series of special elections, including the one in Georgia where they're in a runoff now, where you could say that Democrats are overperforming where you would expect them to based on the November election, and Republicans are underperforming. And I think that's cause for concern for Republicans, and it's cause for optimism for Democrats, but the Democrats are going to have to field good candidates. I mean, more than anything, elections are about the candidates.
Yeah. Well, we hope welcome phone calls. I think our system is We hope it's up and running. Looks like it's up and running. We're going to try. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to keep you out of the phone loop here, but the system wasn't working. So I will invite you now, and I think you can call in now. And I'm sure many of you would like to do that. So apologies for the technical problem. Our phone number for you to join our All Things Political conversation is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. And we'll try and take phone calls momentarily. Jonathan Allen is our guest for All Things Political. He is co-author of the just-released book, Shattered, Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign. I do want to ask him a few questions about that book. We haven't received it yet, and I will read that book, and then we'll have him on to talk about the book, because it's good. Got great reviews and sounds highly interesting. He's a contributor at Roll Call and the head of community and content at TKTK Sidewear. He has reported at Politico. He's also author of the book HRC. All right, we'll continue in a moment here on the Ideas Network. And I'm sorry to say we can't take phone calls. Our system evidently is down, so I'll just keep talking, and Jonathan will talk. We have a lot to talk about, but I do want to tell you, send an email if you really want to get through. That's the way to do it this hour, okay? Email, and that's talk at WPR.org, talk at WPR.org, and that's a way for you to reach us this hour. And Jonathan, I don't have your book yet. I do want to spend some time at the end of the hour talking about Hillary Clinton, but I don't have the book, and so I want to read the book, and then will you do an interview with us about it?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Thanks, Jonathan. Barb on Facebook writes this. Oh, you can go to Facebook, too, and we'll get your messages there. We can't take calls, but the Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Barb writes, when I think Russian interference in our politics, I think that it's totally wrong. Do you think we are reaping the results of our own history of meddling in other countries' affairs? Will we learn a lesson? Have we meddled?
Yes, we've totally meddled in other people's affairs. That doesn't mean that we should be excited or welcoming of other people doing that to us.
All right. The other story that happened was, yeah, this was quite a moment. These three men who stood up to that Portland ranter, racist, anti-Muslim rhetoric, two killed and one badly injured. That story is just staying with me. I think about it a lot.
Yeah, I mean, it's really depressing that, all sorts of violence based on religion or really all violence is bad, but particularly, I think, you know, religion-based violence is really terrifying because it has the effect of, it affects so many more people than just those who are directly harmed, and it has the effect of spreading fear and intimidating people out of practicing the rights that they, at least in the United States, enjoy of, freedom of religious expression or the freedom to not have any religion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm wondering if we're seeing more of that. Do you think that the climate in which we're living, and this was said about that Montana election as well, that there are some people who, for whatever reason, feel that they can express the hatred and do it physically and kill people, too? I mean, I don't remember that being real prominent just a few years ago. Does it have something to do with what's going on politically now, or what?
Well, I do think that, it's so odd to see violence from a politician because politics is sort of war by other means. That is to say, politics is about fighting over ideas, not physically fighting. And it's terrifying that our elected officials wouldn't understand that. It's troubling that they don't have as much, a feel for what their role is. And not that, violence exacted by other people in the civil society is appropriate, but particularly, you would hope that the politicians would understand that. I do think our culture has coarsened, and I do think that there is tolerance at times for violence. President Trump, during his campaign rallies, talked about punching people in the mouth, and in fact, that happened at some of his campaign rallies. And I'm not suggesting that he condones that violence when it actually happens, but his rhetoric certainly indicated a tolerance for it. And, you know, I think that's unfortunate.
Mm-hmm. And he was criticized for not speaking out about this hate crime in Portland a little bit earlier. It is the kind of thing that you want your president to say something about immediately because of the horrendous nature of the act.
Right. I mean, I think there's a long history of the president of the United States speaking to moral issues of the day and trying to set a tone for the public about what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. And, you know, I think there were a lot of people who were hoping that the president would say something and call attention to that. But obviously that wasn't something that he thought was a priority.
Mm-hmm. Back to this circle of people being investigated about Russia ties. We keep going back to that. Evidently, I was reading this morning, Jonathan, that Trump's personal attorney is now included in the Russia investigation. Do you know anything about that?
I haven't done any reporting on it specifically, but yes, that's my understanding. And it's interesting because this is not somebody who has a lot of experience with Washington political investigations. They're whole city full of people that know how to navigate the Justice Department and congressional investigations. And President Trump has instead brought in his personal lawyer, which, you know, I don't want to read too many tea leaves here, but to me suggests that he doesn't think that the end of this is necessarily, fully political, and that there may actually be something substantive to defend himself on. His personal lawyer would be somebody who is familiar with his, presumably familiar with his finances and with his non-disclosure agreements and, the full panoply of legal issues that he's had to deal with over the course of time, whereas there are any number of lawyers in Washington who are practiced in the art of defending clients against both substantive and sort of witch hunt investigations.
Mm-hmm. Let's go a little bit into the Hillary book here, because some of it is Russia related. How extensive, how important was Russian meddling in the election to a factor in her defeat? You've written about this, and we'll talk about it at great length later, but was that a big deal in the defeat or not?
I think it's hard to quantify. Obviously, with such a narrow defeat in such a small number of places, you could turn any number of factors and change the outcome of the election. What I have not seen any evidence of, and our intelligence agencies say there is no evidence of, is tampering with actual voting. So this is a question of whether Russia was influential, through hacking and releasing information, through disinformation campaigns, through those kinds of things, in changing votes. And the thing is, we've learned more about Russian involvement in the election since the election, but this is not an issue that was that people were unaware of. The candidate herself, Hillary Clinton, made the case in at least one of the debates memorably that Donald Trump was a Russian puppet. We had had before the election the conclusion of 17 U.S. intelligence agencies that the Russians had been behind the hacking of a variety of political institutions in the United States, including the Democratic National Committee. And, either Secretary Clinton failed to make that argument, or the public simply didn't think it was as important, or the public in certain places didn't think it was as important as other issues. So, she made that case during the election. One can argue whether she made it strongly enough or effectively enough, but it's not as though the Russian interest in electing Donald Trump was something that we were unaware of heading into Election Day. And I think there were much bigger factors mm-hmm. that put Secretary Clinton in a position to lose to Donald Trump, including the email server, which is the original issue that gave us Jim Comey as a political actor,
right.
The FBI director. And then also I think her inability to articulate a clear message about what she was going to do for the public versus wanting the office. And that's not to say that there weren't things she wanted to do for the public or that she didn't put the public ahead of her personal interests. But I think that her ability to articulate that was suboptimal. And that's something that that people inside her own campaign told me and my co-author.
Does she consider herself, and does the Democratic Party still consider her to be the standard bearer?
I don't think you could define the Democratic Party in any monolithic way right now, if ever.
That's good. That's a good point.
Go back to the old Will Rogers line about not being part of any organized party, the Democrat. I think that I think that there are a lot of people who want to hear more from Hillary Clinton, and there are a lot of people that wish she would go away within the Democratic Party. And that's an unresolved situation. And I think, you know, the easiest way for her to resolve that is to either choose to step aside or to be in the spotlight on issues where she has particular standing and where she might be able to be persuasive and broaden the Democratic Party rather than narrow it. And I think, you know, it's pretty obvious from the election that she was not able to broaden the Democratic Party from where it was during the Obama administration. In fact, we see county after county, including many in Wisconsin, that supported Obama in 2008 and 2012 and then supported Trump in 2016.
A review of your book says that you said this in the book, that she had difficulty articulating a rationale for her campaign other than she was not Donald Trump. I think that there's a lot of truth in that. As the Democrats prepare to take on, I know it's a long way away and I hate to even talk about it, but they are going to be taking on some Republicans in the midterms and eventually gathering muster and steam for 2020. Do they have, do they need also all Democrats to come up with a rationale for their campaigns other than that they're not Donald Trump?
I think less so at the lower the level. That is to say, if you're in a state assembly race or a state Senate race or even a House race, maybe even a Senate race, there's less of a need to do that. I think you have to have some proactive agenda, but it doesn't have to be that sort of cohesive. But I think at the presidential level, you can't just disqualify the other candidate. You really have to offer people something. And I look at the potential 2020 field and I think to myself, you know, if you're a Democrat, you should want the Democrat that is figuring out right now what it is the public wants
right. And
what it will want 4 years from now, and really pay attention to that. Because I think one of the things Donald Trump was very effective at and Bernie Sanders was effective at was articulating the frustrations of the public and then channeling them into policy ideas. And that doesn't necessarily mean that everybody agreed with every one of those policy ideas that, you know, voted for Trump or for Sanders. But with Sanders, it was very clear what he was saying, that what America needed was to take money and power from those who had it and redistribute it more evenly. And then, you know, from the Trump perspective, there was this sort of new nationalism. His term was America First, and there's some ugly history to that. But I do think that you know, a lot of his policies neatly fit into the idea that the United States needed to focus on its own problems and its own strength. And his prescription for that was build a wall, crack down on illegal immigration, pull back from trade deals, and be less entangled militarily abroad. And we're seeing some of that, for instance, with his with his lack of an endorsement of Article 5 at NATO. And even though we are seeing also at the same time perhaps a recommitment to greater military force in Afghanistan and in the Iraq-Syria region, there are indications that, you know, certainly on the campaign trail that he wanted to pull back from that.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that you write about is that it was not a very well-run campaign, that people didn't have much of a sense of who she was, and then all these things put her in the very category of what everybody was upset about, you know, the speeches to Wall Street, the sort of never really knowing how to respond to regular people, to the crowd, always having people around her, not being out there, not even coming to Wisconsin, which I know you write about, which was unbelievable during the whole campaign. It was a swing. It was an important state.
It's interesting. Her first trip with President Obama was supposed to be to Green Bay in June of 2016. And, you know, the first sort of post-primary trip with him, and they ended up canceling that because of the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando, and never came back. And there were some people on her campaign, including those making the decisions, who believed that if they made more people aware of the election, that she was more likely to lose some states like Wisconsin and Michigan, that they would essentially attract people who might not otherwise vote to come and vote against her more than they would be able to attract people who were likely to vote for her. And they essentially abandoned the idea that she could persuade people, which is a controversial attack within the campaign, and certainly since she lost. I think in terms of the articulation of messages, I mean that certainly was a shortfall in the campaign. I, and you know there's a it's interesting, at her campaign headquarters, they had sort of a column in the office where they put up all the things, all the policy positions she had, and it was like all the things, you know, Hillary Clinton is for, and then they had post-it notes up for all the things she was for, and I think there were some people who took from that that, you know, because she was for all these different things, she really wasn't telling people that she was for anything. One of her senior staffers said to me, my co-author, I would have had a reason for running or I wouldn't have run.
Interesting. We're going to, I guess our phones, let's try it. Somebody call and see if our phones are working. That's all I can say. But I guess they may be working now. We have a few minutes left, so we'll just get your comments as quickly as we can. Jonathan Allen is our guest for All Things Political this hour. He is recently, we're talking about Hillary a bit because he's just written a book that just was recently released, Shattered is the name of it, which is an in-depth look at why Hillary Clinton lost the presidential race, and we'll have him on very shortly to talk about the whole book as soon as I have a chance to read the book. Our phone number for this All Things Political, Jared Kushner's Back Channel Moves, Trump's personal attorney now included in the Russia investigation, the president's foreign, there we go, the president's foreign trip, all of it is up for discussion in a few minutes. 800-486-8655 is the number, and this is the Ideas Network. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Let's just go to a Facebook comment. Many presidents in the past, Jonathan, have had influential vice presidents and advisors. Of most concern to me are the persons who seem to help our current president decide about issues and how he will respond. Pence seems thoughtful and deliberate, but Trump listens to Bannon and Fox News opinions, not necessarily their reporters. Is this one of the most potentially serious factors overall?
Well, I mean, I think you can always look at the president's advisors and learn something about him and learn, you know, sort of how he thinks through the people that are around him and advise him. Mike Pence certainly has experience on Capitol Hill, and they have given him a lot of the legislative portfolio. But there are definitely ideas banging around the rest of the White House that I think a lot of people find objectionable. Certainly Bannon and his contacts with the sort of, you know, alt-right community, I think, are troublesome to some. But at the end of the day, Donald Trump is in charge of what happens and what goes right and what goes wrong. And you know, ultimately, that's who's held accountable.
All right, let's go to some phone calls. 800-486-8655. Jeff.
Hello, am I on?
Go ahead, Jeff.
Hi, thank you, Ms. Dunn. Thank you for hosting the show, and thank you, Jonathan, for sharing your thoughts. Wondering if you think that Hillary Clinton got as many votes out of the Black Lives Matter or even the Stephen Avery supporters as she could have. Seems like there's two big groups that are really upset about injustice in the justice system, and they still are very fired up. Wondering if there's any way to know how many of these people voted, who they voted for, and whether Ms. Clinton did everything she could to harness all those votes.
Well, I think it's pretty clear that broadly she underperformed among African-American voters. And, you know, I don't have any polling on Black Lives Matter participants or activists per se, but there definitely is frustration from within the Black Lives Matter movement about President Clinton's anti-crime bill in 1993 and 1994 is when it was actually passed, and, you know, her use of the term super predator at that time, even though during this particular campaign, she had talked a lot about criminal justice reform. So, you know, for a variety of reasons, I think there was some fall off in the African-American community from where President Obama had been. I think some of that was expected, he having been the first African-American president. I think it was expected by the campaign that there would be some difficulty in recreating the exact coalition. And at the same time, you know, I think, you know, particularly, it's interesting, one thing that you might do there is sort of divide African-American men from African-American women. African-American women were about her strongest support of any demographic group. African-American men, there was some fall-off. I know that there's some thought that in some of the states that voter ID laws may have played a role in limiting African-American turnout. But the short answer to your question is she could have done a better job of turning out African-American voters to the polls, and presumably a portion of that is the Black Lives Matter movement.
Rich on Facebook writes this. It's a little lengthy. I'll get to most of it. Why was opening a back channel to Russia such a priority for the Trump clan? Why, of all the important tasks involved in the transition, was this at the top of your list? Why did it have to take place before Trump was sworn in, calling the legality of such communication into question? Who assigned you, Jared Kushner, this task, and what reason was given for it? Do you have any criticisms of Russia's conduct on the world stage? Have you heard from your father-in-law? My criticism and disdain for Trump, the man, and Bannon, the ideologue, pale in comparison to the sickening feeling that these fools, either by design or naivete, have allowed Russia to kick our country in the stomach and in so doing have gained legitimacy as our new best friend.
Well, I think those questions are best aimed at Jared Kushner, President Trump. Mm-hmm. But there's some of those are certainly good questions. I mean, why is Russia priority one? Obviously, Russia is a big player in the world. You would think that maybe China would be a higher priority, that some of our allies, traditional allies, would be higher priorities. So I think that's one of the things investigators are going to look at, why the particular interest in Russia. But, you know, I don't have the answers to all those questions.
No, nobody does at this point, right? Well, how long do you think it'll be before we know the answers to those questions, Jonathan?
I don't have an exact timetable, but I think it'll take a while.
Do you? Like years or a year?
It could be. You know, I think Mueller has already set up his shop. The special counsel at the Justice Department has already set up his shop, and I think he's going to move, you know, as expeditiously as he can. But there are ways to slow down investigations, and I imagine that the larger Trump world will avail itself of some of those methods. There are people who are, you know, who seem to really be on the hook here. Michael Flynn, mm-hmm. probably first among them, the former national security advisor, and he's already taken the fifth with regard to congressional investigations. And I think there are people who are seeking. I know there are people who are seeking immunity right now who are not getting it. Which suggests that Mueller is going to, and some of the congressional investigators are going to really try to pinch some of these people.
Yeah.
And it could take a little while to get stuff out of them.
Why wouldn't you give Flynn immunity? He would talk then, wouldn't he?
I think that there is a concern that you would get less from him in what he said than you would be giving to him in making him immune. And, you know, there's... The other thing that hangs all over all this and seldom gets mentioned is that the ultimate power here belongs to the president because he can pardon whomever he wants, including himself. And while that wouldn't prevent an impeachment and removal, he can't prevent Congress from removing him from office. We're a ways from that if that were to ever happen. But he does have the ability, if he wants, to pardon every single person involved in this from, you know, sort of federal charges and then pardon himself if he so chooses or feels like he needs to.
Hmm. One more call. Sure.
I would argue that's a hole in the Constitution, by the way.
That you would?
I think that's I think that's a hole in the Constitution.
Yeah.
I think
it sounds like it might be.
Amendment that removes the ability of the president to pardon himself.
Yeah. Chris in Grafton, just quickly. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Marlene. By the way, thank you very much for your show. It was an excellent one. My quick question is that Hillary ended up losing by 40-some thousand votes, but there were over 200,000 votes that they found to be, in essence, suppressed in Wisconsin alone through both voter ID and purging of the voter rolls. Had that not happened, would Hillary not have just taken Wisconsin, in fact, by a decent amount?
You got about 15 seconds, Jonathan. Maybe 20.
You know, it's possible, but you know, the voter ID laws may have the effect of suppressing votes. From a legal perspective, that's not an illegal suppression. So I think it's important to keep that in mind.
Ooh, that was good. You made it in less than 15 seconds. Thank you, Jonathan. We'll be in touch. I want to get the book and talk to you at length about the Hillary loss.
It's my pleasure, Kathleen. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jonathan. Jonathan Allen, our guest, he has a new book. And it is Shattered. It's about Hillary Clinton's loss in the last election and getting very, very good reviews. He also wrote another book about her, HRC. Jonathan Allen, our guest this hour, and he is currently a contributor at Roll Call, and he is head of community and content at TKTK Sidewear. He was a longtime reporter at Politico. Thanks to Colleen Leahy for producing this hour. And thanks to Gretchen Brown for on-air production. I think her phones are up and running again, so you can call in hour number two if you couldn't call in hour number one. Thank you very much for listening.